Ellen DeGeneres, host. To be honest, I thought that Lorne would be a tyrant. He seems to have a reputation of being this really mean kind of scary presence, and he was so nice. Just the reception you get. The first day, when you're brought into his office and he welcomes you and the cast comes in and sits in his office, it's such a warm way to welcome the host and makes you feel good about being there. I don't know what it's like to work with him on a daily basis, but the experience I had with him was great, and he seemed respectful of me. I could feel that he liked me. He made that clear. I really liked him. I really thought I'd be scared of him, and he was so nice and warm. He was great. And I think he's good-looking. He's a looker. He's a handsome man, and he's a good dresser. I like the way he dresses. You know, he's a cutie. I think he knows that. He can't not know that he's cute.
Elliot Gould, host. Gilda once said to me at a party after I had hosted, "Look what you've done for Lorne." Perhaps she meant my accomplishments prior to Lorne's success. My coming on the show and working with some degree of consistency on the show, and exercising my humility and my sensibility and giving the show everything that I had. Lorne has always been decent to me, and therefore I'm centered with Lorne. Tracy Morgan, cast member. It's like Luke Skywalker and Obi-Wan Kenobi. Whenever Luke was in trouble, Obi-Wan would come out of nowhere. That's who Lorne Michaels is. He's Obi-Wan. That's what I call him. Everybody has their little nicknames for him. Chris Farley used to call him the Chief. Some people just call him Boss. And some people call him Daddy. I call him Obi-Wan. Bob Odenkirk. I mean, the whole thing was weird to me. The whole thing. To me, what was fun about comedy and should have been exciting about Saturday Night Live was the whole generational thing. You know, a crazy bunch of people sitting around making each other laugh with casual chaos and a kind of democracy of chaos. And to go into a place where this one distant and cold guy is in charge and trying to run it the way he ran it decades ago is just weird to me. Will Ferrell, cast member. Lorne can never tell you that flat out you're hired with a hip hip hooray. The way he told me was, "So we'll bring you out to New York." And I thought, oh, another audition. Then he said, "Have you ever lived in New York?" And that's when it hit me. Oh, I got the job. Then I felt self-conscious because I was so relaxed and I wasn't jumping up and down, and so I was like, oh, okay. And then I said to Lorne, "Well, I'm going to shake your hand." And he was like, "Do whatever you need to do." And then I walked out.
Margaret Obermann, writer. I think Lorne Michaels is a very lucky man, that's what I think. He was at the right place at the right time, and he recognized some very talented people, and it was the right moment and all those things that may become once in a lifetime. I'm not going to say he's not that talented, but he's a producer, and the true talent is what is on the stage.
Danny DeVito, host. What makes Lorne so good as a producer? I think it may be the popcorn. There's a lot of popcorn in his office. He always has big, big bowls of fresh popcorn, and I think that helps. It's really what sets him apart from other producers. And another thing is, he doesn't really care if it drops on the floor. It's like total focus on the board. You could just eat like a slob in that office, and he really doesn't give a shit. With him, it's really all about the show. Steve Martin. He puts people together well. He will suggest something that performers are either too shy or too afraid to suggest. He will encourage partnerships. He'll make the phone call to the person that everybody else would be afraid to call. And he also has this kind of soft wit and patience. Patience with things and people. He loves the youth that flies around those offices. He gets a lot from it. It keeps him hip, I guess. It keeps him puzzled, and it keeps him challenged. Because the new thing is sometimes very hard for older people to tolerate and accept, even though we were all once a part of it. He'll let something go that he might not fully understand.
Sarah Jessica Parker, host. Lorne is not necessarily a demonstrative person, but you know you're in good hands. You know it's not a lack of interest on his part. He's overseeing something and doesn't need to be there hands-on all the time. I think he trusts the host that he hires. Look, he's hired you. He must feel fairly confident in your ability to fulfill your obligations, and he feels he doesn't need to babysit. Gwyneth Paltrow. Lorne can be stingy with praise, but I think you have to be in that environment. They're writing so much each week, and the turnover is so fast, you don't want people resting on their laurels and thinking, oh, I'm funny, Lorne thinks I'm funny, and then anything I write is funny and good. I think it's very important in terms of keeping the show fresh and edgy and funny and young that nobody relaxes, so I think it's Lorne's job to keep them on their toes. Some people are able to make it and go on to other things. Some people can't, and some people end up killing themselves.
Robert Smigel, writer. After my first season, I thought I was going to be fired, because Franken said, well, I know it's not looking good. I mean, you did great, but it's going to be hard. So I went back to Chicago that summer to work on a stage show. I was really expecting to be fired, and then Lorne brought me in days before the new season and just interviewed me. He asked, what was your favorite thing you did last season? It was a very odd kind of short interview. All right, well, we're just figuring things out. I'd flown from Chicago to talk to him, and then all he said was, I'll let you know. I flew back to Chicago and got another call from him, and he said, I don't know, you didn't write for the women much. I said, well, you know, I just did the best I could. I thought I wrote a lot of good things. Well, you wrote good showbiz things, but you gave some of the actors a hard time. So he was saying these things and then said, okay, get on a plane, come tomorrow. It was so weird. People get all paranoid about him unless they know him, and as I got to know him over the years, he's a pretty real person, and he really is in a very difficult situation. Whether he likes the situation and likes the grief that comes with it, I don't know. It's a very difficult setup here. Everybody's pitted against each other. People have egos, and people are insecure, and it's a formula for paranoia. When I was producing the Dana Carvey show, I actually got to see some things from the perspective of being in charge. And I called Lorne and said, I apologize for ever not understanding what your job is.
Rachel Dratch. I never get feedback from Lorne. You always get your notes from some middleman, like, Lorne wants you to pick up the pace here or whatever. Sometimes after the show, if you did a scene that went really well, he'll say something, but he never gets specific, like, oh my God, when you said that line, it cracked me up. You just have to be able to do without stuff like that. Sherry O'Terry, cast member. I don't think you ever really know where you stand with Lorne, and I think that's frustrating because it's almost like a family, even with its dysfunction, because you want to please him. I always say, did Lorne laugh under the bleachers? I don't have much dialogue with him at all. You live for him to say just once, good job. That's the hardest thing, is not having the dialogue that I feel like you should have with your boss. If you want to see him, he'll see you eventually. But sometimes I think you wish that he would offer things to you. You want a little guidance. But he's not that way. And in a way, it's good because he lets you go and you're very free to do what is instinctually there. And the other cool thing is, sometimes they'll say, he doesn't want you to do that. And I'll go in and I'll say, I've got to do that. That's important. And he'll say, okay. He really trusts our instincts, the performers. I think he's very respectful of what our instincts are. One time I came back from the summer and he said, I'd embrace you, but I think I might be coming down with a cold. And I was like, it's okay, hug me anyway. But I'll go up and I will hug him sometimes and I will kiss him whether he likes it or not because I feel it. But it's hard when you don't get it back. I understand people who aren't comfortable with stuff like that. They can just give so much. And I guess he's one of those people. He can just give so much. But when you're working with him, you really go like, anything? Oh, nothing, huh? Like, say good show once. Just say it once, you know? Nothing. And it's like you feel starved sometimes. But then you get used to it, I guess. It's fucking crazy. It really is. Carol Leifer. Lorne and I had such a strange relationship, I don't know what possessed me, but near the end of the season I saw him walking down the hall to go to the elevator, and I hid around the corner. And when he came around the corner, I just went, boo! And it kind of really startled him, and I remember in the elevator going down going, I'm sorry if I threw you off with boo there. And he goes, whatever. He really wasn't happy that I did it. Christine Zander. One week I asked to talk to him after the table read. I think when you ask to talk to him, I think he was always worried you had a problem and you were going to quit or you were going to confront him. I don't think he really likes confrontation. So after the table read, I went into the office and it was sort of tense. But then I sat down and I just said, well, I'm going to miss next week's table read because I have to have an amniocentesis. And he said, ooh, I remember my first amnio. And it was his sister's. But he made it his own. And he was really wonderful about it. We talked for about 20 minutes about how everything would be fine. It's difficult when you're away from it for a long time to try to remember what made you so crazy or what made you so frustrated. And I think you realize, or at least I did, that a lot of it was in your own head, and you can't completely blame him. It's more the combination of people and talent, incredible talent, I think, when I was there, and live television.
Elliot Wald. The only time I met him is when I did a piece on him for the Chicago Sun-Times in 1977. He was very charming. I don't really claim to understand Lorne, but if you talk to enough people, you get a sense of Lorne and you realize that, in his own way, Lorne was just as hard to work for as Ebersol, and in some ways harder. Lorne is more the smart, neurotic Jewish guy who knows exactly where the buttons on your keyboard are, because he has a similar keyboard himself. Ebersol, on the other hand, is more like a boss. If you cross him, he'll just get mad. Lorne, from all indications, is much more like the diabolical version of yourself. He's manipulative, and he knows exactly how to make people crazy. Someone once called him a psychological terrorist. Conan O'Brien. Lorne is very aloof. He's off in his own world. He has a standard joke if you're a rookie writer and he doesn't know you that well. He passed me in the hall once, and he said, "Still with the show?" Then he acted mildly surprised, as if to say, "I thought we got rid of you." And that's his little joke. Still with the show? But I knew I was doing all right, because a few months later, it was late on a Tuesday night, Lorne came into my office. I was sitting at my desk, and he sat on the edge of it and started telling me about this great weekend he had just had in his home on Long Island. I built a fire, and I made some s'mores, and it was really nice because it was very winter-like. And I was sitting there and thinking, I can't believe this is happening. Is there someone else in the room? Is there some consequential person in the room? Because I'm certainly not. Andy Breckman. You hear people on the White House staff talking about FaceTime with the president, and that's what goes on here. When Lorne would come into the office and sit for a few minutes, that was almost, you know, a pat on the back, even though there was literally no pat on the back. Just getting a few minutes of FaceTime with him meant you were of some value to him. Jimmy Fallon, cast member. I talk to Lorne regularly about everything. He's the master. He's been through it all, man. He knows everything. I have to make appointments to see him because I'll talk to him for an hour if I can. I mean, it's like, all right, my next issue is this. I'm getting an apartment. And he'll say, well, I think you should. Whatever it is, he'll give me advice on it. He's just really great. That's the guy I go to for an answer. He doesn't beat around the bush. He gives you an answer and he takes away all the stress. James Signorelli, Director of Commercial Parodies. I swear to God, and I've been around this guy for almost 30 years, Lorne has no interest in what you want to talk about. None. What Lorne thinks is, if you need him to help you solve it, it's not worth solving. And you ultimately are going to solve it yourself, even if he told you a better solution. As Gertrude Stein used to say, you can't tell nobody what they don't know, not even that they don't know it. And he embodies that. I'll come into his office and say, listen, this is what I want to do. And Lorne will say something completely at right angles to it. And I'll go, well, I don't think that's really relevant. And he'll just go, okay. Meaning, I'm not listening to what you're saying. This is what I'm saying. And I know that if you do it, you're going to do it. So what are you here for? Let's go do something else. Let's go to dinner. It's not his job to help me with logistical problems. His job is to look at something, and if he thinks it's funny, to laugh with all his heart and soul. When he laughs, America laughs. Chris Elliott. If you see the movie Man on the Moon, you'll see Lorne and Dave Letterman in it, both playing themselves, and it's interesting how they each approached their appearance. Lorne actually tried to make himself look like he looked back when Andy Kaufman was on Saturday Night Live. He's barefoot, and he's eating with chopsticks in his lounge chair. And then when they recreated the scene when Andy was with Letterman, Dave has his regular glasses on, which he didn't wear back then. He's wearing his regular suit. He made no attempt whatsoever to act in this movie other than to go through the motions. And in a way, it's a lot easier for me to deal with a guy like Dave than it is with Lorne, who's kind of an actor. He's a guy who wants everybody to love him. Dave doesn't give a shit about that. So I seem to be able to read Dave better. The bottom line is, you know, Dave, he's nuts. There's no doubt about it. But he also is what he is. He's never acting, as far as I can tell. He's genuine. And when he's pissed off, he's pissed off. And when he's in a good mood, he's in a good mood. I could never tell any of that with Lorne. Colin Quinn, cast member. I always thought I could tell how Lorne really felt about things. Even though he doesn't say it most of the time, he does laugh. Like at read-through. He reads all the stage directions, which is a hard thing to do. I've read stage directions before, and it's fucking hard. It's a pain in the ass, and he does it every show. You can tell if he likes something or doesn't like it by the way he reads those stage directions. He can be one of the bigger laughers at read-through. But when he doesn't like it, he has no problem just sitting there quietly. Chevy Chase, cast member. There's no mystery about who Lorne is to me, because we came in on the same level, basically. It's just that as time goes on, people become... they're made into a legend by those who were hired, and, you know, Saturday Night Live. Oh, nobody's going to live up to the original cast. Nobody can live up to this or that. But there's one thing that stays steady all the way through. Lorne Michaels. Nobody can live up to that, because he put the whole thing together. He's very non-confrontational, probably both his strongest and his weakest suit. Lorne is both involved and uninvolved in some ways. His lack of confrontational abilities doesn't serve him well on occasion, because he can't fire anyone. He finds it difficult to fire people. That's a lovely thing, too, in many ways. But when the chips are down and it comes to artistic integrity versus the network's fear of what a sponsor might or might not say if such and such a sketch is put on, he's there. He'll confront. Lorne may be frightening to the last 5 or 6 casts, to the younger set, as it were. It may be daunting to be around Lorne. I think he may seem intimidating because he seems to know so much. But he's been there all along. He's a real survivor. Anybody who really gets close to him would know that he is a kind and thoughtful guy who doesn't look to hurt others.
Rosie Schuster. I'm Canadian, and apologies are like mother's milk to us. They just roll off the tongue. I'm sorry I caught my hand in your car trunk, that kind of thing. I don't think Lorne ever apologized to people for keeping them waiting for a long, long time. Instead, he would drop some names, which was a big soother, and you'd have a tidbit to run back and tell your friends afterwards. You can't explain Lorne by Canada, that's for sure. There's an adopted British thing happening there. But there are some other elements that got internalized along the way and inside his psyche besides that. Barbara Gallagher, NBC Vice President. I had one meeting with a unit manager and he made me cry. Lorne found out about it and he was furious. He was very protective. Later on, that guy ends up being indicted in a big unit manager scandal and sent to prison for embezzling. And Lorne sent me the article with a note that said, "The wheel turns. It turns slowly, but it turns."
Andy Breckman. Some executives at Paramount have asked me, because they have that big deal with Lorne where the overhead is quite high, if I know why cast members, once they graduate from SNL, don't want to work with Lorne. I'm sure Paramount's idea when they signed Lorne was that he would be able to deliver the Adam Sandlers of the world and be able to feed them that talent, and he hasn't delivered it. I really don't know the answer. Mike Myers, cast member. As far as not having Lorne produce the Austin Powers films, Austin Powers came out of tremendous grief at the loss of my father. It was an homage to my father and all the fun sort of British culture that my father forced all of us, me and my brothers, to watch. I wrote it. I didn't think anybody would make it. I didn't think necessarily it was something Lorne would want to do. There was never a conscious effort not to work with Lorne. I just met different producers out in L.A. because we were living there, and Lorne was in New York. It just happens to be that some people who showed interest in its very nascent form, are the people I produced it with. It was never a conscious effort to break away from Lorne. I've seen Lorne socially thousands of times. I consider him one of my friends, and certainly one of my teachers. I just met somebody different in L.A., and I actually didn't think necessarily that Austin was Lorne's cup of tea. I'm happy to go on record that the character of Dr. Evil in the Austin Powers films has really very little to do with Lorne Michaels. It has more to do with a composite of all the bad guys in the James Bond films and the Matt Helm films and In Like Flint films. I happen to have a Canadian accent, as does Lorne. It's some vocal quirk which we actually share, being, you know, two guys from Toronto. But for the most part, it really isn't Lorne. It wasn't enough Lorne when I made the first one that I felt it necessary to say anything to him about it in advance. Having said that, Dr. Evil is my favorite character that I've ever done. The only similarity to Lorne is vocally. It's not anything to do with Lorne's character. If anything, he should be honored by it. I would be happy to state very clearly that I do not feel Lorne Michaels is evil. That's a for-the-record type statement. I have nothing but the utmost respect for Lorne Michaels. He's a Canadian hero to me, to be honest with you. I am in awe of him. I did a project on him in grade 8, or the 8th grade, and I would have said project. I was shaking when I met him, and shaking with pride that he's a Canadian. I was never disappointed with how incredibly smart he is. There isn't a day that I don't quote Lorne about some aspect of trying to make sense of show business. It's a situation for which there is no glossary of terms, but Lorne has created a glossary of terms, and I've used it frequently. He's one of the few bosses I've ever worked for who is funnier than I am. Terry Turner, writer. We didn't have a whole lot of contact with Lorne early on. He would sort of go through the halls on, I guess it was Tuesday night, and wander through and say, "What are you writing? What are you doing?" He was a hard man to reach sometimes, but the signals would be out there. You just had to interpret like he was speaking a foreign language. Later on, Lorne really became a mentor for Bonnie and me. I don't know how it happened or where it began. Then at some point, you know, you're under somebody's wing for so long it never rains on you, but the sun doesn't shine on you either. So you realize that you have to get out from under the wing and do it yourself. See if you can do it. Bernie Brillstein. No one remembers that Lorne was a great writer. He's a great editor, and his comedy mind is fantastic. But he's two different guys. He's Gatsby, and he's Lorne the Canadian. He's two different people. He loves that New York life. In fact, he loves New York more than I do, and I was born there. Dana Carvey. Lorne loves New York because, as he would say, you've got finance, you've got the theater, and you've got broadcast networks. It's not this sort of one-trick pony. Dan Aykroyd, cast member. I did get mad once and put a hole through a wall in Lorne's office. I punched a hole in it because I was so mad at the way he would give us last-minute changes before air. We would have to run down and give them to the cue card guys, and they would be going crazy and saying, "Are you kidding? You want us to get this on?" And I just said, at a certain point, "We have got to decide what's in and what's out within each sketch. What are the changes, and they've got to be done in time so that you can get them to cards, and we aren't standing there with them shuffling cards in front of us on the air. Because everything is read on that show. You can't memorize. It's happening too fast." So I had that one episode when I was mad at him, but I never had any other tense moments with Lorne. And that went away fast. Al Franken. After Danny put his fist through the wall, Lorne came in and did his "I'm very disappointed" thing. That's what I remember more than anything else about the incident. Lorne's reaction was of disappointment, like a father being disappointed instead of actual anger. I remember watching that and thinking, that's a smart way to handle this. Conan O'Brien. I remember once he was really mad about a dress that had gone really badly, and we were all packed into that little room afterwards, and he's really pissed, because this dress didn't go well and a lot of things went wrong. And he's like doing that Lorne thing that he can do sometimes, heavy, heavy sarcasm. Because Lorne will not usually confront you directly. He would just say things like, "Oh, I loved how it had no ending," or, "It was brilliant how it just sort of dribbled off." And he's trying to talk about the lousy dress, and I think Bob Odenkirk, who was very junior at that point, whispered to somebody something, and Lorne just went, "Odenkirk, you speak again, I'll break your fucking legs." And it was the first time I had seen him actually swinging into action and actually beating someone up. It really made me laugh.
Kate Jackson, host. I remember when I was hosting, somebody came in and said something to Lorne about John Belushi being in bad shape, and Lorne said, "We're on live at 11:30. He's not allowed to die until after the show."
Andrew Smith, writer. I used to call Lorne every year to see if he had a spot open until the last time I had a meeting with him. He'd kept me waiting for about an hour and a half or more, a long fucking time. And I finally got in there, and then he did his dinner reservations with his assistant during our meeting. Where was dinner going to be? What time was it going to be? That sort of thing. And then that was the end of the meeting. To make matters worse, Lorne still has to be introduced to me every time I meet him. Every time I see him, somebody will have to say, "Lorne, you know Andrew Smith, don't you?" "Oh, yes, yes, hello." I think he's become a full British subject now in his mind. Hasn't he? Bob Tischler. I have been told so many stories as to who came up with the idea for Saturday Night Live. Dick always tried to claim a certain amount of credit, and so does Lorne. I don't know exactly what went on. I can be very critical of the way Lorne works and the way he deals with people and who he is, but the fact remains he is the guy who did put the show together. One of my criticisms is the way he manipulates people. But he did manipulate people to put that show together and to do a good show. Norman Lear, host. I have a routine that I've done with my daughter Kate since she was 4 years old. It's an ancient burlesque kind of sketch. I ask her to help me tell a joke, and she tries very hard and messes up, and I jump on her for it, and she begs for another chance. She messes up in a different way, and I jump on her. And it builds, and I get angrier and angrier at this child. And it was always terribly funny. I had a wonderful, and still have a wonderful, relationship with Lorne, and I told him I'd love to do this, and he saw it, and he said, "Oh, God, that's great, we'll do it." But we're now talking the live show. Lorne had somebody making cartoons. I don't remember who it was, and halfway through this live show, I'm about to come out and Lorne says, I want to run the cartoon, and to cut the sketch with my daughter. So pretty soon, I'm out there introducing Boz Skaggs, my music act, and I'm looking at my daughter, who's sitting with her mother and her sister in such anticipation. And when it comes time to go to the cartoon, I instead start the thing with Kate, and I bring her up on stage and we do the routine, which played very well, very well, and Lorne never said a word to me. But I knew he was furious, and he had every right to be. But it was either my daughter or his wrath, and I chose my daughter. In a show business sense, it was not the thing to do. I'm guilty. But Lorne never said anything to me about it. He also never asked me back.
Ann Beats. I had been out to dinner with my father, and I, of course, had to go back to work. My father was kind of drunk, and against my will insisted on coming back to the office. In the hall, he buttonholed Lorne and started telling him what he was doing wrong. He was basically telling Lorne how to produce the show, and I was horribly embarrassed and mortified by this. I remember Lorne said to me, "He's not you. Remember, he's not you." I thought that was very kind.
Fred Silverman, NBC President. Lorne and I didn't go out to dinner every night. I think he had a different relationship with Herb Schlosser than he did with me. Maybe he needed more tender, loving care at that point in time than I had given him. It's one of those things where you really attack your problem areas. If something is working, like Saturday Night Live was, you say, God bless you, and you just let them alone. I think Lorne mistook that for a lack of love, which really wasn't the case. It wasn't an intentional slight on my part. There were just major fires all over the network. So I think that was part of it. He never felt that he had that daily support and tender, loving care. Andy Samberg, cast member. He is probably the most iconic off-camera person in the history of comedy, and I don't think that's an exaggeration. On camera, you have people like Charlie Chaplin, everyone knows him, but in terms of longevity and the quality and the breadth of success, I think Lorne is unmatched. The way he conducts business is very unique, because the one thing you can always say about Lorne is he genuinely loves comedy. No matter what complaints people have about him, and I don't really have that many, I've had a good relationship with him pretty much from the beginning. He is in it for the right reason, and that is to make funny, quality entertainment. He came up on comedy. He loves it. When somebody is new and funny, he gets really excited. No one is going to ever say that they would compare anyone to Lorne. Steve Higgins, supervising producer. About 4 years ago, an old cast member came back to host and wanted to redo a sketch they had done at Dress that had never made it to air. They loved the piece and said, I want to do this one thing. So I mentioned it to Lorne and he goes, yeah, but you know what? There's a weird shot in that piece. I said, what? He goes, there's a weird shot. There's a line that just was off. I go, oh, okay. Are you kidding me? And I walked away and thought, he's crazy. What is he talking about? So I went and watched the sketch from Dress, and there was a weird shot. There it was. It just didn't fit. So 4 years later, some crappy little sketch that was just at Dress is still in his memory bank of things. When you read about Buster Keaton making movies, you learn he was always left alone. That's what this place is. Lorne keeps everyone away so you don't get noted to death on stuff. So if it's awful, it's our fault. It's funny to me that people go, he's not there a lot. Well, no, he is. Oh, but he doesn't come to the tapings. No, he's here every day. Well, he doesn't blah, blah, blah. No, it's his show, and this is the thing he cares about more than anything else in the world. He loves the other shows, but this is his baby. Buck Henry, host. I wish he'd make better movies, but then I wish I'd make better movies, so that's no big deal. It wasn't a mistake for him to come back to the show, because it's what he's done the best.
Molly Shannon. Lauren's a deep thinker. He can analyze anybody. If you want an analysis of somebody, go to him. He's the best. He'll be like, well, he's da-da-da-da-da. He can sum somebody up in like 30 seconds. He's very quick and a very deep thinker, and he's very loyal. Loyal to a fault. So many of the same people who've worked there for years, these families he supported, they're still there. The loyalty is phenomenal. He's very loyal. Just rock-solid loyalty like I'd never seen before. Amy Poehler, cast member. I like to squeeze Lorne a lot and tell him I love him and kiss him and pinch his butt. That's who I am. Maya Rudolph, cast member. I weirdly stopped being nervous around Lorne when I had to go into his office and tell him I was pregnant. But that was my fifth year. Before that, Lorne always made me nervous because I always wanted to be a good girl in front of him. And deep down, I think I wanted him to think I was great. And I didn't want to piss people off. I was always afraid to speak my mind. But that was also coming from a 27-year-old with a brand new job and not knowing where the fuck I was and what the fuck to do and how to do it. I didn't want to get fired. That's what's really going on when you work there. When you look back and you realize, oh, he must have thought I was really shy, because I never talked to him and I never really spoke up. I was just a diligent, good girl and did my stuff and went home. But once I had to go into his office and tell him I was pregnant, which was, weirdly, a month after Tina had to do the same thing, everything about our relationship changed. What came first out of that conversation was he was worried, because I had done a sketch where I fell through a piano, so he said, I can't believe I just let you fall through a wire foam piano last week. I hadn't told anybody I was pregnant yet, because I wasn't finished with my first trimester. So he was upset with me that I did that, which was really sweet. So after I told him I was pregnant, I've always been a lot closer and familial since then, and it actually allowed me to speak up and go to his office and start speaking my mind. I just felt really open with him and comfortable with him in a way that I hadn't before. He's probably the most loyal person you will ever know. Probably to a fault, because he knows a lot of people, so I don't know how he does that. I love him.
Dave Wilson, director. A long time ago, a reporter was interviewing the renowned composer Jerome Kern. The reporter asked Kern what he felt was Irving Berlin's place in American music. Kern answered that Irving Berlin was American music. And that's the way I feel about Lorne Michaels. Lorne Michaels is Saturday Night Live. He made it a legendary hit. And then he kept reinventing it to reflect that young adult audience's tastes in topical comedy and in popular music. Chris Rock. I've never been broke a day since I met Lorne Michaels. When I met Lorne Michaels, I lived in a little studio apartment. My family lived in the ghetto for the most part. I met Lorne Michaels, and me and my family have been more than comfortable ever since. Bernie Brillstein. My dad died in New York, and the funeral service was 10:30 in the morning. The last person I think that's going to be there at 10:30 in the morning is Lorne. But he was the first one. That's Lorne. His depth of feeling, his depth of being hurt, is really tremendous. And so is his depth for enjoyment. He's really the most unique guy I've met with his loyalty. We've been together 30-some years, and he was romanced by the best of them, but he's never left me. Tim Meadows, cast member. I walked around the corner once just as Lauren's children were freeing themselves from their nanny's clutches. I saw him get down on his knees, and they ran to him and piled all over him, and I thought, man, you've got it going on, brother. You got this thing working.
Scarlett Johansson, host. It's very rare that you meet people in this industry that have had the experience that Lorne has, that can be charmingly jaded, yet still have a curiosity about what's going to work, even though you'd think they'd go, I know what works. He doesn't feel the need to put on that masculine vibrato thing and kind of take control and throw his weight or any of that. He's quietly confident, and I think it makes everybody in that working environment feel kind of safe, like they can take a risk and not be shot down.
Billy Crystal, cast member. We had one really nice moment together after all this time at the 25th anniversary show, where I came out as Fernando. I had a great 4 or 5 minutes. Great to be back in the character again. It really was a very strong thing. But Lorne walked me to the mark backstage and met me back there, and he was very warm with me, and that was very nice. Paul Rudd, host. He's one of those guys where it seems like everyone I know who talks about Lorne immediately goes into a Lorne voice. Nobody can say anything that he said without actually trying to sound like him. He's that iconic, I suppose. John Hamm, host. My favorite thing to do with Lorne, and you get ample opportunity to do this, is listen. Because the guy has 50 years, or however long he's been in showbiz, and he's been through every version of every situation that you'll come into. From inspiring you, to talking about losing jobs, and getting jobs, and keeping shows on the network, and reinventing shows, and just every iteration of every problem you'll ever have. Lorne has been through it all probably 7 times. He's a great storyteller, and his experience is so wide-ranging that you'd be remiss if you didn't try to take notes. Tom Hanks. Lorne invented this thing. It's hard to imagine now the place that Ed Sullivan held in the esteem of the country and the medium of television because he was on every Sunday night. But it was a substantial thing to go on the Ed Sullivan Show, just to get the shot in the first place. And then to be called over and shake hands with Ed and maybe even chat with Ed before you went off. When you did Sullivan, it was literally a watermark for anybody's career. And if you did well on Sullivan, it guaranteed you some spot in the firmament. You could say the same thing about the Johnny Carson show. And I think you could say, even though he's not the actual host, but he is the godfather of the show, I think you could say the same about Lorne. He is this very particular sort of show business maven that only exists in regularly scheduled television. It doesn't exist in movies. Lorne's produced movies, but other than getting them made, I don't think you could say he's had a resounding influence as a movie producer. But in the medium of TV, where you do a show week after week, Lorne has maintained this level of pacemaking influence that has not altered over the years. Saturday Night Live has remained socially relevant literally because of him.
Lena Dunham, host. The energy surrounding Lorne seems to be respect, which is what it's supposed to be because of the fact that this is the house that Lorne built. What impressed me so much was his ability to be so decisive. You think to yourself, how are you going to know when something on SNL is too broad? Sketch comedy is broad. But somehow he is able to cut in and be incisive about, that moment doesn't feel real. And you look at it and you realize, oh, that's why SNL works. Because in the midst of the insanity, there's these incredibly real, well-observed human moments. And Lorne is encouraging those. At the meeting that happens between Dress and the show, I can't believe he's saying, the guest is overlit. That curtain needs to be a shade brighter. You really need to pick up your cue. The fact that he was able to see the big picture and see those little things as well was just crazy. It was someone at the height of their powers, someone who had a complete understanding of a medium that ultimately they had invented. It is really amazing how Lorne was able to both express his unique vision and foster the talents of different people. I mean, it's a very impressive thing and very intoxicating. Marilyn Suzanne Miller. I was in Los Angeles writing a novel and found something in my breast the size of a lemon. So I got on a plane an hour later and came back to New York. Within 24 hours, I knew I had breast cancer. Mine was advanced breast cancer, which is to say I didn't have metastatic breast cancer, but I did have a huge tumor with many nodes, So I had experimental chemo. I told my manager I don't want to go back to L.A. I'm too scared. So I was going to stay in New York and have this chemo and radiation. And I was just in shock. At that point, I didn't know if I was going to live or die. It was very aggressive cancer. Lorne had, of course, been on the phone with me. Everybody from the original show called, the family thing again. Our ties are very emotional. Then one day Lorne called me up. He knew I wanted to be in New York for the treatments and that I had left a job in L.A. And he said, "How'd you like to come back to the show?" And I thought, "Yeah, love to." So in the spring I went back. Back home. To Saturday Night Live. Cecily Strong, cast member. Lorne had a meeting with me on my worst day. I looked at him and just started sobbing. On the show right now, we're such a young cast. It's humiliating to admit that anything could get to you. It's humiliating to say I've read the bad things that are out there about me. I had talked to my therapist that day, and she had asked, "Is there anybody who could give you advice? Who knows how to do this, how to navigate this?" Lorne didn't talk down to me, and he wasn't upset at me at all. He was very fatherly. He has a really fatherly thing about him. I was crying, and I said, "Can I have a hug?"
Alan Zweibel. I'd like for God to give me back the time that I invested in trying to figure Lorne out. I would like to have those hours and weeks and months back. I guess it's like someone trying to figure out their parents. There was a real need for validation from him, and now that I've been away from it for so long, when I do see Lorne, there's still that thing where you want him to know that you're doing okay. You want him to be proud. You're like, "Hey, I had a part in this." So there were ill feelings at one time, but they were born out of a different situation. When most of us got there in 75 and started the show, Lorne's predictions started coming true, and we said, "This guy's a prophet, you know? Look at this, everything he's predicting is happening. I'll hitch my wagon to his horse." And then years later I went to the 25th anniversary show. It's funny because it didn't feel like 25 years, but as you looked around and you added up stuff here and there, well, yeah, I guess that does equal 25 years. I was sitting there looking around at the people who were there and coming on stage. I was thinking, look who came through here. Look at what it gave birth to. And look at how much money there is in this room right now. And I thought, look what Lorne did. Look at what he's done. Dan Aykroyd. My dad's 95, my mum's 92, and their minds are real sharp. They read the paper every day. They look at the television news, and they're right up on everything. It's just the mobility that's the thing, but by the time I'm 90, there'll be an exoskeleton that I can climb into so I can run down the road and jump up and grab coconuts. That won't be a problem, mobility then, so you can keep the mind straight and the brain straight. With what they're developing now, we'll be hovering everywhere. Phil Himes, the lighting director, he's 91 this year, and he's still there. Don Pardo still does the announce. He's 90. That studio's had a lot of long careers. Chuck Yeager can go to any jet on the planet now. He's near 90. Get into it and take off, and he does. So why shouldn't Lorne be there at 90?
Anne Beats. Lorne did have a note from Gilda on his bulletin board that said, "Lorne, I'm happy. Love, Gilda." But enough about Lorne. What about me? This has been a Highbridge production, read by Paul Woodson and Christina Delane. Copyright 2002 by Thomas W. Shales and Jimmy the Writer, Incorporated. Material new to the 2014 edition, copyright 2014 by Jimmy the Writer, Incorporated. Preface to the 2015 edition, copyright 2015 by Jimmy the Writer, Incorporated. Recording copyright 2017 by Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.